Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
It is Labor Day weekend, you know.
It is indeed. Not that we actually mark Labor Day in the Bettinelli house.
Right. I work anyway. I have a podcast to record and that sort of thing. And school, we do school. But
we do not take a holiday.
No. Yeah, we take some holidays, but yeah, this is one we generally don't. Yeah, it is interesting. I remember when I was a kid, this would be, right now would be the Jerry Lewis Labor Day telethon. And I would always regret going to bed. I have, just as much as Anthony has FOMO, that was me.
That's where he gets it from.
That's where he gets it from. And so I would go to bed and I would like, oh, what am I missing all night in the 24-hour telethon? Who's singing and doing silly comedic acts, and how much money will the grand total tote board be when I wake up in the morning?
You're not missing anything.
I used to love the Jerry Lewis telethon. It was such an event. It was such a huge event. It wasn't even just like a national event. Like, it was like a local event. The local Channel 5 would have a big thing going on at their station, and we even did like carnival, like a family carnival. Like we'd set up special booths and things and raise money for it and bring it down and put it in the bucket. And it was a big deal. It was a big, do you remember that at all?
I remember that it was something that it was on TV that was kind of boring. That's my entire some knowledge.
I wonder if it was as big by the time you were older and in Austin as it was elsewhere at other times, but it was a big cultural thing. It was something that brought everyone together which we don't have a lot of those things anymore, but yeah, it was pretty cool. Anyway.
Yeah, totally. Sorry.
Those days are long gone. Anyway, let's talk about what we've been doing. We've had our first week of school.
Well,
sort of.
Isabella had her first week of school, and everyone else is sort of sliding, easing back into things.
Easing. Not yes. rushing in. Yeah, yes. That's right.
Today I've been working on trying to get a checklist up and running for Sophie. I've still got some books to purchase and things to iron out, but it's kind of slowly coming into shape.
Yeah, she got up Saturday morning and did her homework, her math work, because yes. She didn't realize it was Saturday.
She was very upset when she realized that she'd done her math for nothing.
See, this is homeschooling. Like, the kids don't even know what day of the week it is. They need to, like, once we get into the school year, so to speak, they will have a much better sense of this is Saturday as opposed to the rest of the week. I think that sort of thing comes back to them. Like, did you ever like get up on a Saturday morning as a kid and get ready for school?
Not that I recall.
You're not a morning person, so your mom probably had to blast you out of the bed every morning anyway, right?
Well, I mean, I was more of a morning person until I hit my teenage years. Uh-huh. In fact, you'll be amused by the fact that I was the kid who my parents couldn't take to a party because I was like, when I was really little, because I'd always want to be in bed, in my own bed, by 8 p.m.
Wait, that doesn't surprise me at all. You're an introvert. You hate socializing.
No, well, but I was very firm on the 8 p.m. bedtime thing as a kid.
You must have been a joy to your parents when they wanted to have a social life.
I did not take well to the, like, being out and about.
Well,
which is one reason why I suspect.
Yeah.
I've never really done the, like, going out and about with our own kids, because that just strikes me as kind of cruel and unusual punishment.
Well, I mean, with Bella, we did a lot more out and about with her, and we paid for it. I mean, there were plenty of rides home from places where she screamed bloody murder from the back seat. So yeah, we did pay the price. We learned eventually. Well, the other thing that we did this week is on Friday, it was a beautiful gorgeous day, like gorgeous,
absolutely
late summer gorgeous day. And you took the kids out to Burridge Pond. It's a place we talked about a while ago. When was that?
Back in like
in the spring?
April, May. It was in the spring.
Yeah. And this is a place that's not too far from here. That's a former cranberry bogs and former a bunch of other things. It really has an interesting history.
It was a cedar swamp. And then it was they
had some type of factory.
They logged the cedar swamp. Then they harvested the peat. And then eventually they made cranberry bogs.
But there were some factories in between, too. There was like this whole thing. And now it's owned by the state. It's conservation land. But it's wide open. And the boggy areas are still there. It's a big haven for birds and other wildlife. However, you said that it wasn't birds this time.
We went hoping to finish up the bird lists for the two scouts who were doing the bird merit badge. And we saw lots of birds at Burridge Pond, so let's go back there. Well, we saw lots of birds in the spring, but now it's fall. And
all those birds have gone somewhere else.
We saw them on a cloudy day, and it was sunny, and that can make a difference too, but I suspect it's mostly just the time of year.
Yeah.
So we did see a snowy egret, and we actually saw a lot of swallows, like dozens and dozens of swallows, which was kind of cool, but it only really counted for...
It only counts as one.
Well, two. I think Bella, I distinguished that there were barn swallows and cliff swallows.
Very nice.
So she managed to knock two of those off her list. But yeah, there's still a ways to go before they finish off their bird list.
Oh, man. This is not an easy merit badge. We had
a really nice outing, though. For the most part.
You went like later in the afternoon. You took a lunch.
Yeah, we left at about noon, and then we brought a sack lunch and had a little picnic.
Cool.
Of sorts.
And this, like I said, it was a gorgeous, beautiful day with beautiful clouds. I'll use one of your photos as the episode artwork because it was a really beautiful picture.
Yeah, I mean, the sky, the clouds were just
puffy,
breathtaking.
Puffy clouds,
big,
skies.
Big, beautiful cumulus clouds.
Yeah, it's awesome. So I did not get to go. I had stuff to do. I had work. But yeah. We'll see.
Yeah, we...
We're entering into my favorite time of year. This is my very favorite part of the year, the fall. Because, you know, apple picking. So, like, produce, like, all the... Like, it's... People think summer's when all the produce comes in. No. Fall. This is why they had Thanksgiving.
At least around here.
Around here. But lots of produce and things like we're going to go apple picking, which has apples and pears and cider donuts and apple cider. Mm-hmm. And then the nights get a little cooler and the sunsets a little earlier, which I'm not excited about early sunsets, except it gives the opportunity for the kids and us to go outside and look at the stars.
Which we did on
2 days.
Saturday
Friday?
Night?
No, I think it was Friday night. It might have been last night. Yeah.
We saw Jupiter out the window, and so then everybody ran outside to go see more stars.
Yeah. That was fun. That was a nice, fun, spontaneous look around.
Star watching.
Yeah. I mean, again, Bella's the astronomer, but we're all able to find things with the help of some apps and that sort of stuff. It was fun.
Yeah, I'm getting better at picking out constellations other than the Big Dipper and Orion.
Yeah. Same here. But the more you do it, that's what it is. So fun. Yeah, that was good. And hope, like I said, I hope we get to do some. My hope is we can go apple picking this week. This is the perfect time right now for us.
That would be nice.
That's I'm penciling on my plan. Put it that way. One other thing that's been going on is Bella's gotten this bug for photographing her Star Wars figures, whether they're minifigs or the Black Series action figures or whatever, but all her Star Wars figures, photographing them in action scenes with her iPhone. And I found on Instagram, someone had like a series of photos that they had done, and they were like they were kind of edited a bit to add in special effects, and it was really kind of cool. And I showed her, and she was very excited. And so I said, you know, let's get out the good camera, and you take some really nice photos with the good camera, and then we can edit in things like lightsabers and blaster bolts. And then we looked at a tutorial online on how to do that in Photoshop. So I thought it was kind of fun, you know, doing these Star Wars photos with Isabella and kind of feeding her creative impulses that are combined with Star Wars.
She's been taking photos of them for a while on her own.
But, yes.
But the idea of doing some slightly fancier ones is really exciting.
Yeah, she wants to put them in the grass and, you know, make it really look really cool. Speaking of Star Wars, it was just a funny story when we were at the farmer's market yesterday as we record. All except for Melanie and I think Bella all had Star Wars shirts on as usual. And someone who doesn't know us says, is it like a Star Wars day or something? And I said,
every day is Star Wars
Day. It's always Star Wars Day. We always wear Star Wars shirts. It's just the way it is. This is the way, which is a whole different thing. Well, actually, it's not a whole different. It's still Star Wars.
But it's still Star Wars.
It's still Star Wars. All right. So that's what's been going on. That's what we've been doing. Let's talk a little bit about what we've been eating and cooking. I made a new dish the other day. Alexa, stop. It did that the other day in another one of my podcasts. Like, I didn't. It's telling me about Taco Bell.
I don't know.
I don't know why it has suddenly gotten this thing about wanting to interrupt me. I'm going to have to take it out of this room, which is a pain in the neck because I use it for stuff. I wish there was a way to kind of turn it off. Like I can turn off other things. Anyway, as I was saying, I made a new recipe this week called grilled black pepper, honey, marinated skirt steak. I have to say it in the right way. Otherwise, it sounds really weird. So I'd gotten some skirt steak on sale. I love to look for the special markdown, buy it today, the last day to buy it before it expires sort of sales on meat. And I buy a bunch of it and throw it in the freezer. And so they had some skirt steak, so I got some. So what this is it's a quick marinade. Like, this is so quick, you could make this on a weeknight after when you get home from work. So you take you take some soy sauce, honey, Dijon mustard, black pepper, and thyme, the herb. And then you mix it up and whisk in oil to make a marinade. Okay? Then you set that aside. It doesn't touch the raw meat. You take the steaks and then you sprinkle them with sugar, salt, and pepper, okay, in various amounts. Then you throw those on the grill, you cook them up, and when they're done, you take them out, put them in a 13x9 pan, and you poke them all over with a fork, and then you pour the marinade on then. And then you let it sit where it will absorb all of the marinade.
So it's not really a marinade, it's more like a sauce.
Well, it's a marinade in the sense that it's absorbing it. Like, the whole idea of a marinade is that the meat absorbs. Well, this is a way of getting the meat to absorb it just after as opposed to before. And you can use the leftover marinade as a sauce because, like I said, it didn't touch raw meat. I liked it. Kids didn't really like it that much.
The kids are not huge fans of skirt steak.
And it's chewy, yes. The skirt steak is chewy, and that's just the problem. They have been ruined by really good steak.
They just don't like chewy meat. I don't think that even if they'd had tender meat, I don't think they would.
I know. It's hard because, I mean, it's not cheap meat. That's for sure. Skirt steak is not cheap. And I try, you know, doing the cutting against the grain. This time I really did cut it against the grain and cut it thin, but it didn't work for them, I guess. I don't know. I like having, you know, different kinds of textures in the steak. Like, sometimes I like a nice tender steak, but sometimes I want something that gives me some chew. I mean, I like beef jerky, so what do I know? As far as the flavor goes, though, I liked it. The pepper was good. And what I do with the pepper is I toasted the peppercorns in a dry pan. So you just throw them all in a dry pan, put it on a medium or medium low heat, and then you swirl it every once in a while. And what you're looking for is either wisps of smoke, or if they start popping a little bit, almost like popcorn, or if you get a strong smell. I don't know why I couldn't get the smell. I mean, maybe that my allergies are latent in the background. I wasn't getting a lot of smell in him, but if you do it, sometimes you get a very strong pepper smell, a floral pepper smell. Anyways, if you toast the pepper and then grind it up in a grinder, it is so much better. It is so, like, it's like a whole different world of pepper flavor. It's really good. So that's something I made the other day. I liked it. I liked the sauce that it makes, the marinade. It was really good. But today you picked up some beets at the farmer's market yesterday because you wanted to make carrot and beet curry.
Yes. My favorite.
Which you've made before, but I don't think we've ever talked about.
We haven't really.
I looked, I didn't see it.
I cannot believe we haven't talked about carrot and beet curry.
I'll look it up again, but
it is because it's so good. Carrots and beets just really go nicely together. And I've experimented with different kinds of curry. I think the first time I made it, I like just threw some beets into our regular like chicken curry. And some of the kids who regularly like curried decided that made it inedible. So then after that, I decided to try to just make it as a side dish rather than the main dish, putting beets into the main dish. So it's kind of a stripped down version of the curry because it's just the carrots, the beets with some garlic and ginger and onion. I did add tomato, like crushed tomatoes, though, because I think that the acid of the tomatoes helps to cut the sweetness of the beets and the carrots. Like, otherwise, it can be a little bit too cloyingly sweet.
Yep.
I put a lot of curry powder in it. Like, well, not a lot, actually. I just used a really spicy curry powder. So it had a lot of heat.
Yeah.
I used coconut milk, but also like a good half cup of Greek yogurt. No, plain yogurt.
Plain Greek yogurt.
I think we were out of the Greek.
No, it's Greek.
No, you used the Greek in your curry. I bought
the Greek yogurt. It's the same yogurt. Anyway. I will go get it and show you after we're done recording. Go ahead.
Anyway, it has a really nice earthy flavor and sweet, but spicy. It's just kind of a perfect.
So apparently we made this back in July.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Okay, I totally forgot. But it was different then, like you said. Like, this was better.
I think last time I actually added some of the cauliflower into it.
Yeah.
This time it was just the beets, the carrots, and the tomatoes.
But as you said before, this had a better balance to it.
Yeah. I also used the Colchester curry powder.
Right.
I used the fish curry blend, which I mean, it's like, look, we have one for beef, we have one for chicken, and we have one for fish. I went with the fish because it just kind of, I don't know, sounded right.
Yeah.
It felt right.
ColchesterCurryHouse.com.
And then I added some cumin, too, because it felt like the beets wanted cumin. So I was just listening to the beets. It came out really good. I was really happy with it. And I'm going to eat it all the rest of this week.
I should mention that Colchester Curry House was a sponsor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World for a few months. So, and we bought a bunch of their spices.
Really their good spice curry blends.
So
they're
good.
They're a lot hotter than other curry powders I've used.
Mm-hmm.
So like I used a teaspoon for the entire pot of curry and it was hot.
Yeah.
It was.
He also has a fire and spice masala mix. So that would be interesting. It is not for the faint of heart, he says.
Yeah, I just used the fish masala.
Yeah.
Which was good. It's a very simple, like there's not a whole lot of ingredients, but it's just really got a nice flavor to it.
I wonder if he would like the apocalypse pepper jam that the jam ladies had at the farmer's market.
Probably.
Oh my gosh. Apocalypse.
Was
pepper.
It apocalypse or Armageddon?
No, it was apocalypse.
Okay.
Because there's a pepper, because it's made from the apocalypse pepper. Like the names of pepper, like we used to have nice names like poblano, jalapeno, habanero. Apocalypse, burn your head off. Anyway,
or the Scotch bonnet, which sounds like it's going to be so
Scotch bonnet
pleasant, like, and friendly. Oh, and
Scotland, how bad could that be? It's cold and it's rainy. There's no spicy food in Scotland. It's not from Scotland. It's a hot pepper. They don't grow hot peppers there. It just looks like it looked like a Scotch bonnet. Anyway,
yeah.
So that's what we've been eating this week. So let me talk about some of the stuff that I've been watching.
Okay.
I watched a new Netflix movie called SAS, which stands for Special Air Service.
SAS, not SIS.
SAS, Special Air Service. It's the British Special Forces. SAS, Rise of the Black Swan, which is what it says on Netflix. On IMDb, it's called SAS Red Notice, which is apparently it's based on a book called that its title is Red Notice. I'm not sure why, whatever, they've changed it, but a Red Notice is a killer capture order or something like that.
Okay.
And the SAS has our military in the U.S. cannot have any law enforcement functions unless martial law is declared. That is apparently not true in Britain. So the SAS does have an anti-terror role. They conduct anti-terror operations. It was an all-star cast. Like, it has Andy Serkis, who played Gollum, of course, everyone knows, and Noel Clarke, who I remember from, and you remember from Doctor Who. He played Mickey in the first couple seasons of the reboot of Doctor Who. But also Tom Wilkinson, who you've seen in everything. He's an actor who's been around for ages. Tom Hopper, who was in Umbrella Academy as the big dude. The big gorilla.
Oh, right. What was his name?
I have no idea. I can click
Gunther?
Him. Gunther, yes. Gunther. Very good. He was in it as one of the SAS soldiers, who was taller than everybody, of course. And then Ruby Rose was the main antagonist. She was in John Wick, I think, or something. But she always plays very aggressive. I don't say mannish because she looks like a woman, but very violent criminals types. Hannah Joan Kamen, who I knew from, she did a sci-fi series a few years ago that I liked that wasn't very well known, but it was called Killjoys, which was pretty good at the time. Anyway, so it has a big cast, very good cast. The main lead actor is his name's Sam Heughan. Never seen him or anything. It's kind of a trope. He's one of the best SAS soldiers around, but he's the son of from a family called Lord Buckingham, and he's an orphan, and it's sort of like he's almost like Lara Croft Tomb Raider. You know, he comes from money, but eschews all of the trappings of it. Except he lives very well in luxury, but he rides a motorcycle, so he's very dangerous. You know, it's very, very kind of a bit of a trope. But the storyline is that there's this basically a mercenary group that are hired by this giant British company called Britgas, who are building a pipeline in like Armenia or Georgia. I forget which one of those it is. And to basically terrorize villagers into giving up their villages so they can build the pipeline through it.
Okay.
And it's being done by the British government. Like, the British government is hand in hand with this gas company getting this done through these mercenaries. And then something goes wrong and they have to disavow, and they send in the SAS, and all kinds of things happen. And it ends up with the train in the Channel Tunnel.
Uh-huh.
Being hijacked, and there's a whole thing that happens in the Channel Tunnel with the hijacked train. There's a whole subplot about sociopaths. Like, there's this voiceover at the beginning where Tom Wilkinson in character is talking about sociopathy and how how common it is in society, and it's uncommon, but those who have it have a special ability to do certain kinds of things, and they're found in all kinds of walks of life. They're not always criminals or villains, but sometimes they're the good guys. And there's really this thread in it about being a sociopath, a good guy who's kind of a sociopath. Uh-huh. Like, in other words, he can kill, he can hurt without compunction.
But he does it for the right people.
For the right reasons, right. But it doesn't bother him to have to kill other people, you know, to be violent.
Right.
But then the question is what's the cost? Can he love? That's the question. Can you also love if you're a sociopath? And so you have these kind of the evil sociopaths and the good sociopaths. And there's a whole other subplot about somebody is betraying somebody and we don't know who, and you get ideas and so on and so forth. It was okay. It was a pretty good action movie, as action movies go. I thought some of those subplots were kind of interesting, and I'm curious if they're going to continue to make any sequels of it. That might be interesting. Might be pretty well done. The way they left it left some open threads, things that could happen. So I watched that on Netflix. And then, and of course, Andy Serkis was awesome, because Andy Serkis is always awesome, whatever he does. He's just so good. And then I mentioned a few weeks ago that I was watching Schmigadoon on Apple TV Plus.
I thought you mentioned that last week.
Or last week. I don't know. The weeks merged together in my mind.
Uh-huh.
So I finished the first season. Who knows if it could be other seasons, but I finished the season. And it was fun and amusing. I liked the trope of the 21st century New Yorkers caught in an old fashioned musical. It got kind of liberal, progressive, preachy at the end, almost like predictably so. I'm like, oh, did you really have to, those bad old days where people were judgmental and let's celebrate all the new things. And it was kind of like, meh. I was a little disappointed with that. But it was still the rest. Apart from that, it was funny. It was fun. It was a little crass at times, I'll be honest. There was some crass stuff. But it was good. I still liked it. I hope they do more another season. Let me put it that way. What's his name? Michael Keegan Key, I think it is. Is really good in it, but also the now I have to look up the names because I don't want to get them wrong. So Keegan-Michael Key is the guy, and he was really good. He was the half of the team of Key and Peele, who like he did the short video of Aaron, he was the substitute teacher getting all the kids' names wrong, and okay. Getting mad. It's a funny video. And the other lead is what's her name? Here it is, Cecily Strong from Saturday Night Live, who actually was really good. I mean, I'd never seen her in anything else, and she did a really good job in this. So that was really good. Then let's talk about the other thing we watched together, which was the next episode of Marvel's What If.
That was very dark.
Very dark. So
it was good, but dark.
Quick recap: What If is a animated series on Disney Plus that imagines what if something was different in the Marvel universe that we know, and how would that play out? And so in this case, it was what if Doctor Strange didn't lose the use of his hands, but instead lost the woman he loved. So he wasn't alone in the car when it crashed, and gained this ability of the Time Stone and the ability to change time.
Right. It was grief over her loss that sent him on the path to becoming Sorcerer Supreme, as opposed to
trying to regain his
lost hands. They kind of glossed over like exactly how that worked. They went from the car crash to him becoming Sorcerer in like a nice montage scene.
Right. Well, because they had a whole lot of other stuff they wanted to do.
Right. But I felt like the motivations there were a little bit murkier. Like, how do you maintain the whole Man of Science thing?
Yes.
I was a little bit less convinced by this premise, but it was interesting to watch it play out nonetheless.
Yeah. And again, they had all the original voice actors. So it was Benedict Cumberbatch and the other the other actors that we know. I think that this episode, so there's a split where there's basically an evil Doctor Strange and a good Doctor Strange. And they do battle. And I think this is because of the what we know about what's coming up in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, including the what is it called? The Doctor Strange and the Multitude of Multiverses, or whatever it is.
Multiverse of Madness.
That multiverse madness thing that I think that's going to play into it. And then it might even be that the Doctor Strange that we saw in the Spider-Man trailers is not actually Doctor Strange, but might be another Doctor Strange who's bad, like this bad guy.
That's, interesting. Yeah. Theory.
I don't know. I felt like there was more to this than just a one off.
Well, this is the thing, the question I've had of sort of about all of them is, are these one off shows or are they introducing something more?
Right. Is there more to it than just an animated gimmick?
But essentially, he tries to reverse time and it's kind of like Groundhog Day in reverse.
Yes, it just gets worse and worse and he gets worse and worse. You're right. It's like a reverse Groundhog Day. That's true. And it things go horribly wrong and he needs to absorb power and he starts absorbing evil or becoming evil because of all the power he's absorbing that he needs in order to essentially break what's a fixed point in time, to use a Doctor Who phrase.
Essentially, it's he is willing to take any means necessary. Like he loses sight of like what is just justified means to get hit to his end.
Right. He loses sight of
the ends justify the means.
Right. He loses sight of why he's doing it. You know, he kind of goes crazy with grief.
Right.
Especially because he starts off by trying to save her, doing like trying to make a change every loop through. And every loop through, she still dies somehow. Like she has to die.
She's fated to die.
Right. She's fated to die. I think that makes him go crazy.
I kept wanting somehow for it to loop back into the original timeline. Like I really kind of at one point expected that he was going to get to the point where he realized that he couldn't save her unless he gave up his hands. And that was the loophole that he was looking for, was one where he sacrificed his hands in order to save her so she doesn't die.
And so the resolution would be a positive one in the sense of his self-sacrifice of his hands is what saves
her. Right, so even if he doesn't remember it, like the fact that he lost his hands was a bargain that he had made in order to save his life. That would have been so much more satisfying.
I kept waiting for the TVA to show up. But of course, this is the timeline that's supposed to happen in this universe. I don't know. I still have problems with the whole TVA thing.
The multiverse.
Yeah. Mm. Anyway. Yes, but it was still good. It was just very dark.
Right. It was a good story. It was good storytelling. And I liked it. I mean, I didn't dislike it. I would have written it differently.
And Benedict Cumberbatch was really good. So was Benedict Wong. They had both Benedict. I didn't even realize that until I just said that out loud.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. Weird.
Which is funny because we have a Benedict, so you would think that you would have an extra affinity for the name Benedict.
We do? We do! Just kidding.
He's so funny.
So let's talk about some stuff we've been reading.
Wait, do I get to talk about what I've been watching?
I asked you before. This was the only thing you mentioned.
No, I said I've been watching The Bad Batch and
Mysterious Benedict Society.
Mysterious Benedict Society.
Which one I said? Is there something specific you want to say about those? And you said nothing. Which is usually no.
I was looking for a book.
Okay. So, apologies. What would you like to say about those two things?
Now that I'm, like, put on the spot.
On the spot. Come on, let's go.
Okay. I am really, really liking The Bad Batch, I have to say. It's fun to watch it with the kids. Like, it was worth racing through Clone
Star Wars. Star Wars The Bad Batch. Yes. Animated series. Yep.
It's good. It picks up where the Clone Wars left off, like, immediately where the Clone Wars left off, the Clone Wars animated series.
Right. It literally starts with the very end of the Clone Wars.
And as we're getting into it, we're picking up, we're hooking back in some characters from the Clone Wars series, which is, it's very satisfying to me because now we're filling in some of the, like, what happens next.
Yes.
Part. It's so fun to watch the kids too, because they have so much more of a, I don't know, they really enter into the moment. They have this sort of joy and enthusiasm, and they're really like,
well, a lack of cynicism that adults would bring to things, or embarrassment.
Right. And just like, I ended up not watching the Clone Wars with them just because I'm often trying to do something else at that time slot. And I didn't have the ability to shuffle things around, but I'm realizing watching the Bad Batch with them, like what I missed out on in not watching the Clone Wars with them, because there is a certain, like, sometimes my more critical self kind of comes in and says, you know, oh, but this and this and this. And like, they don't really have that critiquing it. They're just, they're in it for the ride.
Right.
And it's kind of fun.
I mean, they think about it.
They do think about it, but they're not in terms of a, what's wrong
with
it. Not
trying to poke holes in it.
Right. They just sort of accept it for what it is. And,
And they just want to fit it into the world. Yeah. It is a lot of fun.
They love it. They get very excited, like the character moments, like, oh, there's Wrecker being Wrecker again. And, oh, of course. Well, so-and-so is doing this because this is what they do. It's fun to see them kind of, I don't know, appreciating the character, appreciating just in terms of like characterization and plot.
Right.
And then the Mysterious Benedict Society, it's been ages since I read the book.
Uh-huh.
So I really, like, I only have the vaguest memory of what it's about. So I'm watching it, like, it's almost like our roles are reversed. Like, I'm watching it going, I don't know what's going to happen next. And they all have just read the books, like, several times, like, very recently. Like, Lucy just finished reading the series. And so they're, like, very interested in terms of what's different between the TV show and the book. And they're like, oh, well, in the show, they did this instead of that. And I wonder, I really like this better, or I kind of missed that. And it's really fun to watch them then doing that comparison between.
Well, this is their first big experience with a book that's been made into a show or movie or anything.
I suppose it is.
Yeah, they. It's...
Because they haven't seen any, like, of the Harry Potter movies.
They haven't seen Harry Potter or Lord of the Rings or anything like that.
This is true.
You know, I mean, even the Star Wars books they've read have not, they've read the novelizations, they're just novelizations of movies as opposed to movie books that have been made into, right.
Yeah. Anyway, it's fun. I really like the Mysterious Benedict Society. It's a fun, quirky story.
I'm an episode behind. I've seen the Bad Batch, so I don't watch it with them in the afternoon. But I'll watch the next episode of Mysterious Benedict Society sometime this week. But it is fun. I like the kids. The kids aren't the best actors out there. I mean, you can kind of sometimes see them acting, so to speak. But it's still fun. And the adult actors are really good. I recognize all of them from other things that they've done.
Right.
And it's kind of a fun world that they've built, kind of an interesting, very, very kid-like world. It's very uncomplicated. It's very, not that there isn't an interesting story or a complex plot, but it's straightforward.
It is very straightforward.
It's not subtle. There's no subtlety in it.
Yeah. It's just.
Yeah, it's good.
I'm sorry. I thought I was going to say something and I forgot what I was going to say.
Okay, well, let me move on to talking about the book that I wanted to talk about.
Okay, talk about books.
So I haven't finished it yet, but I'm still working on the book called To Wake the Sleeping Giant by Jeff Shara, and it's a novel about Pearl Harbor. Now, Jeff Shara, you might have known him, or his dad, I think his dad wrote the book that became Gettysburg or The Generals. And they write historical novels that they try to adhere as closely to the actual historical events as possible. They don't postulate too far outside it. So in this one, you're following basically three different points of view. You've got Yamamoto, the Japanese admiral, who is the architect of the attack on Pearl Harbor, who is also the guy who said, we're going to start this war with America and we're going to lose. Like, he knew that Japan would eventually lose. The only hope that they had, but the attack had to go on because Tojo and the Japanese army were dead set on it, on this conquest. So he said, our only hope is if we can destroy the American Navy at Pearl Harbor and get the run of the Pacific. And if we don't, we'll lose. And he was right. So Yamamoto, and then Cordell Hull was Roosevelt's Secretary of State. And so he was, and as we see, was working to preserve the peace, to negotiate the peace with Japan, even as he knew, you know, that things were going badly. And then a sailor from Florida, this guy who's 18 years old, who enlisted in the Navy, became a sailor. He's a pharmacist mate on the on a battleship in Pearl Harbor, the Arizona, which, like, every time they talk about it, I'm like, oh, I know, like, does he survive? Like, these other people on the ship, are they going to survive? It's like, oh, I'm just like, I know what's going to happen. It's like watching the Titanic. And it's good so far. So I'm about halfway through. And it's a very interesting look at the way people were thinking at the time. There was mm-hmm. some people were convinced, like some, like the Secretary of War, Stimson, and General Marshall, the chief of staff, they were like, we need to take the entire Navy out of the Pacific because the Japanese aren't going to do anything. They're not going to attack us. They would never attack us. We need to put the whole Navy in the Atlantic because we've got to protect our shipping to Britain because we've got to support Britain against the Nazis. And I mean, it was really kind of wild how blind people were to what was coming. There were a lot of signs that people should have noticed, but there was a lot of arrogance on one hand. Like, no one believed that Japan could hit Pearl Harbor, could hit Hawaii. So it's a pretty good book halfway through. So we'll see where it goes. We're getting very close to the actual attack. So I'm going to guess that the attack itself occupies a good, nearly half of the book.
That's not, surprising, so, I suppose.
Yeah. So what do you wanted to mention a book or something that you've been reading, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So first of all, I'm like halfway through. I've reached the halfway point of Years of Rice and Salt. We've hit the colonial era where the Chinese have started colonizing North America. So far, they only have some small port settlements.
Right.
And our main characters have tried to rouse the Native Americans and get them to fight back, like, preemptively.
Against the Chinese settlers.
Against the, imperialist Chinese.
As a reminder for those who may be new, this is Years of Rice and Salt is a book.
It's an alternate history.
Right. By Kim Stanley Robinson.
It imagines what if
the Black Plague in Europe killed off 99% of the people instead of 25%.
Right. Now we've jumped. I feel like the narrative keeps jumping away at like the most interesting point, and then we don't get to follow up on what actually happened in the aftermath. And I keep getting frustrated with that. So I don't know what happened. Like, I know that they ended up fighting in North America, maybe, but I don't know what the result was. Were they able to push the Chinese back or not?
Oh, wow.
And so now we've jumped back to China. And we have a Chinese woman married to a Muslim scholar, and they're kind of he's interested in trying to reconcile Confucianism and Islam and find some sort of a synthesis, a midway point where the two faiths can meet. His Chinese wife is like totally dubious about this prospect. Like, she's like, you're trying to connect the five pillars of Islam and the five principles of Confucius, and like, this just does not work. Like, they're not even on the same page. But they're kind of a fun, like, what I'm finding is that I really, really like the characters. Like, each set of characters as they come up are really interesting people, and I want to spend a lot more time with them than the narrative gives me.
Each one should have a book, you mean?
Yeah, like they're really interesting characters. It's just that, like, the story keeps jumping away from them and, like, going on to their next reincarnation. I'm not really as sold on the through story, which there seems to be this sort of desire. Like, they forget who they are when they're reincarnated, but then every time they die and they're in the sort of afterlife, they remember all their past lives. And there's this, like, plot that they're trying to overthrow the gods and, like, get some sort of cosmic justice.
Oh, weird.
And I'm not really sure that, I mean, I'm really not buying into that part of the plot line.
Like, he almost should have just had different people throughout history that he's following. Like, just jumping from one set of characters to the next.
I mean, I would at least enjoy that more, but I don't know. I guess I'm waiting to see if there's some sort of payoff that I find
satisfying.
Right. Then with the kids, we picked up a new book this week, by one of my favorite authors who I've talked about a lot on the podcast before, Atunuke, who's a Nigerian, British, like she's from, was born in Nigeria, but lives in Britain now. I think she lives in Wales, actually.
Okay.
So she has a new series that she's just started called, the first book was called Too Small Tola. And it's about a little girl named Tola, who's very tiny. Reminds me a bit of Lucy. She's tiny and fierce.
Mm-hmm.
And she lives with her mom, her grandmother, and her older brother and older sister. And her older sister is like very studious, and she's always doing schoolwork because she really wants to get straight A's. And her older brother is obsessed with soccer. And I think the father is in Britain working and sending back paychecks, and the grandmother is taking care of them. And they are not especially well off. They live in a big rundown apartment complex that frequently loses electricity and water. So one of the three stories in the book involves the kids having to get up early and go stand in line at the pump to fill up all the, to get all the water that they're going to need for the next day, for all the washing and stuff. Mm-hmm. So there's a great story about Tola and grandmother going to the market, and they're both very small and they have to carry all the heavy purchases on their heads home, and bargaining for the different things. Grandmother doesn't read. She's illiterate. And she just doesn't count very well either. So Tola takes care of like the counting the change and making sure that they're getting the right amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, grandmommy's supposed to be buying a mouse for the computer, and she does not understand what a mouse is. So there's this fun like dynamic there, but grandmother is very powerful, and there's this almost a little Red Hen sort of story where they keep having to stop and rest because their loads are so heavy, and every time they stop and rest they get a treat. And so then they get home, and the older brother and sister, who did not want to go to the market, are like, wait, you got soda pop and donuts and I forget what else, like you got all those treats. She's like, well, you could have come to the market with us.
This is exactly the dynamic that happens in our house.
Right.
Bella goes to the grocery store with me. She gets a donut at Dunkin' Donuts when we're done.
Exactly. I really liked the you know, this is a family in Nigeria, and yet the dynamics are so very similar.
Yes. I noticed Sophie started going with us.
Hey, free donuts.
Free donut.
And then there's some fun things where they go to the market, and all the neighbors are calling them like nonstop, asking them, could you pick this up? Could you pick up that? Could you get some diapers? I need some super glue. And then the old guy upstairs asks them to bring his TV, and grandma just hangs up the phone.
Like, bring up his TV.
I don't know who was calling. Like, this little teeny, tiny old woman is supposed to carry your TV home, like miles from the market.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. But there's this sense of community, I think, which is really nice.
Cool.
And then they fight a bully in the last story, which was really satisfying. Nice.
Yeah, it's really as kids' stories set in Africa, in African culture, not, you know, Europeans who living in Africa, that, which is when you'd see a kid's story set in Africa, that's how often it was. It was like European kids who were missionaries or some other thing living there. This is Native African contemporary, not, and living in the city, not living right. in the
bush. There's a great moment in which they pass by the shopping mall and they feel the blast of cold air coming out. And grandmommy is like convinced that people who have traveled to the West, like to Europe or America, have somehow magically brought back the cold air. Like, she does not understand air conditioning, and Tola tries to explain it, and just it's lost on her. But I really love that it's modern, it's contemporary, but it's written from the African perspective, like by an African author who, and yet she's writing for a Western audience as well as for presumably an African audience. So she kind of is writing it for the British kids or the American kids who aren't necessarily going to know, but there's some Africanisms, there's language and stuff that she doesn't translate. So you just have to kind of pick up on
figure it from context. Yeah. There's kid stuff from Asia, there's stuff from South America. So it's nice to see stuff coming from Africa too.
And you know, I feel like publishing for kids has really changed a lot since I was a kid, that there's a lot more stuff from all over the world that we can have access to. And I love it. This is like the kind of stuff I would have loved to read when I was a kid, and it just didn't exist.
Well, and a lot of the stuff when we were kids that was born was old and full of old stereotypes and stuff, like Ping and other stuff, which I still love as a story, but it's got a lot of stereotypes.
It's got a lot of stereotypes,
but it's like Chinese people don't live like that anymore. Like, that's not, I mean, so I suppose some people do, but that's not the normal experience of that culture. I want to read about the normal experience of that culture.
Right. People who have cell phones and computers and yet they're not just like a glamour of Africa on top of Westerners. Like, they really think and live like Africans.
Right.
And it's a different culture, completely different cultural context.
And it's not like a European who's gone to Africa. And so from a European or American perspective, what they're seeing, it's the lived life. Which, I mean, a perspective of a foreigner to a land can be an interesting story, but it's just, we've had a lot of that. This is nice to get something that isn't that.
Yeah, so Atanuke, really great. She started off as an oral storyteller, like telling traditional African stories. And there's something of that oral quality to the storytelling that's really just...
I think this... If you ever get a chance to hear a folklorist or a storyteller, like, take your kids to it or just hear it yourself, it's not just someone telling a story. There's an acting part of it. It's different.
You can find her, a lot of her videos on YouTube, and she's a great storyteller. Oh, just so she's hilarious. So funny. She's just.
Okay. Gushy. So
I'm a fangirl.
Let's move on to our last bit I want to talk about is, as we're recording, it's September 5th. It's the 23rd Sunday in Ordinary Time. It's also the Mother Teresa's feast day. So there's two things I want to talk about. Talk about Mother Teresa in a second, but I want to talk about the gospel because of something that came up today. So in the gospel, it's Jesus is healing the guy who's the deaf guy. Who's deaf and mute. And so it's very earthy. It's very physical. Like, there's Jesus is revealing his divine power, his divinity here, but Mark is also making it clear, he's very much a physical person. He's a physical being because he puts his finger in the guy's ears and spits and touches his tongue.
It's very sacramental, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
Like, in the way that
it's
the
incarnational.
Right. The sacraments use water and wine and bread and physical touch and oil. And here Jesus uses his saliva. And
did he spit on his tongue? That's what I'm a little dubious here. I'm a little worried about it.
Spitting touched his tongue.
Did he spit on the ground? Did he spit on his hand? Did he spit in his face? Like, it doesn't say. But the other part of it was he looked up to heaven and groaned and said, Ephphatha, which is be opened. And it's very interesting because someone on Facebook asked Jimmy Akin, you know, why did he groan? What's the groaning? And Jimmy says, well, it's like when you're getting ready to do some hard physical labor and exertion, he's gathering up his power. He's, you know, when the weightlifter picks up the weight and he grunts, you know. And it's funny because before Mass today, I was in here like getting my shoes, and I bent over to pick up my shoes, and being an old man, I grunted, ugh, you know. And so he's like, why do you do that? Why do you make that noise? I'm like, well, it's because I'm old and to bending over. I'm not flexible as I was, and bending over is an exertion. And we got into talking about why do people make noises? Like, why do we make a noise when we smack our hand? Like, when we hurt ourselves, why is that satisfying? Why do we do that? And there's a power in it. I think I saw read once that it actually helps psychologically to vocalize when we are under stress of one kind or another, good stress or bad stress.
Interesting.
And so
Jesus, being fully human, also feels the need to make vocalizations.
He groans.
I also wonder if, like, you know, he talks about the spirit interceding with groanings when we don't know what we should pray for.
Hmm.
I wonder if there's a certain aspect of this is the spirit speaking with Jesus, through Jesus, in Jesus.
The spirit groaning, the spirit, the action of the spirit in Jesus, sort of the groaning of the spirit. Hmm. It's an interesting idea. Huh.
I have to say, the more I read the Gospels out loud with the kids, the more I just have questions. Like, I stop and think about things. I'm like, you know, this story doesn't really make that much sense.
Until you understand the context, yeah.
But sometimes even when I do understand the context, well, like, there's just, I have questions.
So one of the things that's kind of funny in this Gospel, it's one of these funny disciple moments. Jesus, he ordered them not to tell anyone about what happened. But the more he ordered them not to, the more they proclaimed it. I'm like, were they sinning? Was that a sin? Like, was it bad that they proclaimed it? Like, why didn't he want them to tell anyone?
Which is interesting, along with the idea of being opened, moving from being mute to being able to speak, in a way.
Jesus is telling them to be mute.
Right. But in a way, he doesn't have the power to keep them silent. In fact, I always wondered if there isn't almost a reverse psychology, like, don't tell anyone, because he knows that by telling them not to, it's going to make them talk even more. Like, there's an interesting.
Now, don't tell anyone. Oh, we won't, Jesus.
There's an interesting back and forth. But thematically speaking, he opens the man who can't speak, who has a speech impediment, and he's now able to speak the praises. Like,
and once he opens up that guy, everybody has to speak. Nobody, they can't not speak.
Right. It's almost like he it's not just the mute man who has been opened up. It's everyone.
And maybe it's not just he cures a speech impediment, but he puts the words in him. He like Jesus is literally putting the word in him, and the word must be proclaimed. You can't not proclaim the word once it's in you in that sense.
Right.
That is interesting. One of the things, so Scott Hahn talks about this in his salvationhistory.com site. He does homily reflections for priests. And one of the things he mentions is the first reading is from Isaiah, and it pretty much is the prophecy of this thing.
Yeah. Right. He makes the
eyes of the blind will be opened, the ears of the deaf will be cleared. You know, this is God. Here is your God. Literally, it says that. Here is your God. He comes with vindication, and all of these miracles will happen. Okay. So Mark shows Jesus fulfills Isaiah's prophecy. In fact, he uses the same word for speech impediment that is used in Isaiah, in the Greek version of Isaiah, the Greek translation of Isaiah for mute. The tongue of the mute will sing. The word that is used there is the same word that is used for speech impediment. And it's the only place in the Bible that word is used. Those two places. So it's clear. Boom. This is God. Mark is saying, remember, Isaiah said, when you see this, you will see this is God working. And so Jesus is doing it. So draw the conclusion. Make the dotted line. So
which later we see John the Baptist asking, you know, Jesus, who is sending his disciples to ask, who are you? And Jesus says, well, tell John, the blind are seeing and the deaf are hearing and the lame are walking and this is what's going on.
Right. And the gospel ends with him, the people saying he has done all things well. And that is a reference to Genesis 1:31, where God saw all the things he had done and declared them good. You know, that is a reference to the divine power. Right. He has done all things well.
And God saw that it was good. Here the people are seeing that it is good.
It is good. Right. So, really kind of cool. And then the other thing I want to mention is because it's Mother Teresa's feast day, and we have a first-class relic of Mother Teresa, which I don't think I've ever told that story. I'll try to look it up beforehand, and I don't think I've told this story before.
I thought we talked about it, but maybe not.
I might have, but if it was a while ago, and
tell it again. It's
we
okay.
We have new listeners, and anyway. I'm just going to quickly see if I did, but in any case, yes, I did once before, but it was a long time ago. So, we have a first class relic of Mother Teresa. I got it because when I was in college and I was in a household, we were the guys and I were making financial sacrifices during Lent, and we were going to give the money to a charity. And at the end of Lent, one of my friends was heading to Russia. This is 1993 or so, so just after all the events. He was heading to Russia on a trip, a missionary sort of trip. I don't want to get into it, but he was going to Russia. And I gave him the money. I said, find a charity to give it to. I think it's what I said. And he ended up giving the money to the missionaries of charity who had just showed up in Russia. It wasn't that much. It was like $50 maybe. I mean, it was college student change.
Right.
And then he told them it was from me, like personally. And so I get this letter from Russia like months later. I'm like, why am I getting a letter from, like, 'cause this is like he'd already come back. It was all this stuff. And then it was this holy card of Mother Teresa with some hair secured to it by some cellophane tape and a letter thanking us for the donation.
It also has a bit of fabric, I think maybe like from her sari.
Oh, yes. Right. This is the fabric. This is a third class relic, too. And I'm like, OK, this is awesome. Because she wasn't even dead at this point. Like, this was before she had died. So it was kind of like, wow. Like, everyone knew that when Mother Teresa eventually died, and she was quite old even at the time, that she'd be declared a saint. So it was, I guess technically it's not a holy card then. But in any case, it's a prayer card.
It's a prayer card.
With a picture of Mother Teresa and some of her hair. And anyway, pretty awesome. We have it on our prayer shelf with a couple other relics of St. Faustina, Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati. Am I missing one?
No.
Okay. I thought there might be another one. But anyway, all that said, it would have been Mother Teresa's feast day today if it wasn't a Sunday. Father Roger Landry is a priest, a friend, who I helped him with his website. And he's right now working at the Vatican's mission to the UN. But he has a website called CatholicPreaching.com where he posts his homilies. And so he had a homily for today is from a nuptial mass that he did for this couple in New York. And in the homily, he says that a friend of his, Tom Hoops, a Catholic writer who some of you may have heard of, was getting married in 1992. And he and his wife, his fiance at the time, they decided to send wedding invitations to people, you know, sort of on a lark, like a who knows, maybe they'll show up. And so they sent a wedding invitation to President and First Lady Bush, George and Barbara. They invited Pope John Paul II. The Bushes sent, the White House sent a sort of congratulations card. The people at the Vatican sent a papal blessing, which is really kind of cool. I wish we'd thought of this.
No kidding.
They also sent an invitation to Mother Teresa in Calcutta. They got a long, typewritten, personally signed letter that gave them advice in preparation for their marriage.
How awesome is that?
No kidding. So he quotes it at length. And let me read you part of it. So Mother Teresa wrote, "On your wedding day, you will receive many gifts, some very expensive ones also, but the most precious gift you will be receiving on that day is the gift of each other. So know each other as God's special gift of love to you, and love and cherish each other. Keep the joy of loving each other and share this joy." And then she urges you always to see the other as a precious gift, a gift from the other for sure, but also a special gift of love from God. And it goes on and on. And I just like, how cool is that? Like, it's not only is it a letter, a personal letter to them for their wedding day, which is an heirloom. It's a relic because it was personally signed. Right.
Right.
I mean, how awesome is that? So it's a really good homily. I'm going to make sure to link it in the show notes so that you can read. Father Roger does a podcast of his homilies. He has a podcast feed that you can subscribe to. He's a great homilist, and you should definitely give it a listen, especially since he will probably be a bishop in the not too distant future, and probably a, who knows, archbishop, cardinal, something or other. It would not surprise me at all. So check that out, definitely. Anyway, that's
cool.
That was my thoughts. So I think we should wrap it up there. We do want to take a moment before we do to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create raising the bets, including Adam N., Lucas D., Russell T., Joe S., and Stephen B. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue raising the bets and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So we'd love to get some feedback from you on what you thought of what we talked about today. You can do that by commenting at sqpn.com/bets, that's B-E-T-T-S, or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia, or send an email to bets@sqpn.com. Relevant links from our discussion are in our show notes at sqpn.com. Remember to like Raising the Bets on the StarQuest Facebook page, retweet us on Twitter where we're at SQPN, and leave us comments in all those places. We love to hear from you in those places too. Until next time, I'm Don Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.